ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is Nightlife on ABC Radio. If you've been lucky enough to snorkel on the Great Barrier Reef, or maybe luckier still to dive into the beautiful blue waters of Southeast Asia, you'll know that it's as spectacular below the surface as it is above. Myself, I could spend all day swimming with the fish and with the jaw-dropping coral reefs. The visibility, well, there's a reason that people travel from all over the world to dive in Southeast Asia. And then there are the shipwrecks. Now, the ocean floor in this part of the world, in Southeast Asia, is littered with shipwrecks. Many of them contain priceless historic artifacts as well as cultural heritage. And that's become a problem because these priceless historical artifacts are actually worth big money, and it makes them a target for commercial and illegal salvage operations. Now, an Australian research project is trying to reconnect the objects in private collections around the world with the ships that they originally came from, to piece together their amazing story and to help us gain a picture of what might have been lost or sold on. Associate Professor in Archaeology Martin Polkinghorne is at Flinders University, and he is a co-investigator on the project, and he's very good with murky maritime history. Welcome, Martin. Hello.
Hello, Andrea. Thanks for having me on your program tonight. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Well, I wonder if you might set the scene. Indonesia to our north is the largest archipelago in the world. What records do you have of ships travelling through there?
Well, Southeast Asia and specifically Indonesia, as you say, was really at the heart of an incredible boom in global trade along what we've been calling recently the Maritime Silk Route. And although there was global trade much earlier, the mid-1400s, the mid-15th century, was really a decisive epoch in world history, because this was the first time when there were direct trade routes between China, Europe, every corner of the earth. At this time, some historians kind of broadly characterise it as something called the Age of Commerce. It's a time when we see the collapse of the great agrarian empires like Angkor in Cambodia and Bagan in Myanmar, and the rise of the coastal ports like Malacca and Ayutthaya in Thailand. Indonesia, in particular, because its geographical position in the centre of the world and its treacherous seas, it really holds the history, this history, in its territorial waters, where shipwrecks extending from, China, Japan, Southeast Asia, India, the Arabian Peninsula, and also Europe are lost at sea with their cargoes.
Well, given what you're describing, it's a time of great upheaval. You're talking about the collapse of agrarian empires, which would have fed quite a number of the peoples of the area. What sorts of journeys would these ships have been making with their cargoes? What cargoes would they have been carrying?
Well, they're carrying a wide range of cargoes. Primarily the things that we see today are trade ceramics. So most of these are commodities themselves, produced between the 1400s and the 1900s. And these are mostly Chinese ceramics, but there are also significant ceramics from Thailand and Vietnam. Now, these kinds of ceramics are really the first mass-produced objects sent throughout the world and made to be exchanged for other high-value objects like metals, rare forest goods, textiles. And I would really say sort of embodied in these objects is really the history of the Maritime Silk Route.
And we do need to think about it that way, don't we? The Maritime Silk Route, so it had as much importance as the Silk Road across Asia and into Europe as well. So what was it about, you mentioned the treacherous seas, what is it about these seas that is so treacherous? I mean, sometimes when we look at them, the distances on the map, they don't look very far.
It's true, but if you, have a look on a map, at Indonesia, it's really sort of in the centre of the world there. If you want to travel from anywhere in North or East Asia through or to India through the Arabian Peninsula or even further, you need to go through Indonesia. I mean, Indonesia has the third largest coastline in the world. And I mean, there are very sort of narrow passages in which these ships have to pass. So it's according to some 2022 statistics from Indonesia's Ministry of Marine Affairs, there are over 700 known shipwrecks. But in fact, others have estimated that there are many thousands of shipwrecks to be discovered. I mean, the issue for us as archaeologists is that only a few have been studied in detail at the moment.
Okay. Well, I wonder if you can bring us into the present now and let's have a look at these shipwrecks. Firstly, who owns them and who's responsible for their commercial salvage or indeed their illicit salvage?
Every country, so there are international frameworks that govern these shipwrecks, principally the 2001 Convention on the Protection of Underworld Water Cultural Heritage. But really, every country itself has, like Indonesia, has really preferred to use their own laws to manage underwater cultural heritage. However, enforcing these laws can be hit or miss, and they're often vague and can be interpreted in different ways. And this is the case in Indonesia, where the laws have been largely inconsistent and confusing. Also, I mentioned the huge coastline of Indonesia. Because there's so many historical sites, it really is tough to enforce these laws. Also, another issue that complicates matters is that there's a tension between this perception of how much money can be made from these underwater objects, a tension between that and their importance as cultural heritage.
And I guess the money often wins out, right?
Well, it has done to date, mostly, although there's a growing recognition of the cultural importance of these objects. And that's been growing since the 1980s, and particularly in the 1990s. Between 1999 and 2009, the Indonesian government actually had a moratorium on the salvage of shipwrecks.
Yeah, right. So tell me then about how your project was kicked off. I understand there was a generous donation of a private collection of ceramics involved.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, generally our project started from this need to protect the shared cultural heritage of our region for present and future generations. You know, since the 1960s, Southeast Asia and Indonesia specifically has seen a rise in both commercial and illicit salvage of underwater cultural heritage. And objects like the ones I'm speaking about, ceramics, can continue to this day to be taken from underwater sites, sold through middlemen, salvage companies and auction houses to collectors and museums. Thousands, maybe millions of these objects have been dispersed around the globe and including to Australia. Now, some time ago, a prominent arts philanthropist in Australia invited myself and another senior colleague to look at his collection of Southeast Asian ceramics, which he had amassed during the 1960s. Now, these objects were purchased legally from antique markets in Indonesia and imported legally into Australia. And they number about 2,300 objects. And so we started to, develop a project about what we could do with these objects, and a project to work hand in hand with our Indonesian partners to reconnect them to their shipwreck origins.
And how do you go about doing that? What sorts of records do you have available to you to be able to match them potentially with the shipwrecks? Is it difficult?
It is extremely difficult, unfortunately. Actually, we're really lucky. Our principal partner is the Ministry of Marine Affairs and Fisheries in Indonesia. So they manage all the shipwrecks. Now, they have... You know, so in Australia, in Adelaide, we have this collection of 2,300 objects, but that's really dwarfed by their collection, which is 10 times the size at 230,000 objects. And this is located in a warehouse in West Java. It's the single largest collection of trade ceramics from the Maritime Silk Route. So we're lucky to partner with the Indonesian Ministry. So we know where the fine spots of these objects are from in Indonesia and some others that we're working with in Indonesia. But we don't know the fine spots of these ones in Australia. So really, because we know where the objects are from in Indonesia, we can use them as a reference collection to determine the origins of the objects that we don't know. And maybe to go in a little bit more detail, we're using different methods of archaeological science to sort of create a fingerprint, if you like, or a profile of each object.
And so what do you do with the objects once you recover them, identify them, figure out what shipwrecks they belong to? I mean, there must be thousands of them. Why shouldn't a few of them stay in people's private collections?
Well, I would really say that, I mean, the issue for archaeologists is the issue of context, and that they're mainly perceived in people's private collections as economic and aesthetic objects. But really, for an archaeologist, I would say here is that they've lost their context. They've really lost their cultural meaning, and this is really what we're trying to recover. Now, this idea of context in archaeology is super important because it really tells us the story behind the artifacts, like figuring out how the pieces of the puzzle fit together. To use sort of like a simple analogy, imagine divers find a shipwreck at the bottom of the sea. And if they just pull up a bunch of objects without noting exactly where each item was found or what was around it, really the whole story gets lost. And as archaeologists, what we're interested in doing is understand the totality of the items. So it can tell us what the whole ship was carrying, where it might have been going, what kind of people were on board. Maybe it was a pirate ship. Or maybe there were luxury goods on board. As I said, without context, artifacts are just aesthetic and economic objects. But with context, they become windows into the past. And it turns objects just from being, museum pieces into real living history. Objects held by our ancestors and by the ancestors in our region.
And so you've been going for about 2 years now. What is the story that you've managed to reconstruct from this work? What's some context you've been able to put around some objects that you've found?
Well, yeah, I mean, I have to say we're really sort of in the preliminary stages of our work. And we've really, at the moment, kind of established our methods and how we're going to go about doing this. We do have some leads. I think you'll probably have to come back to me to at a later stage for me to give some precise identifications. But I can tell you about the kind of methods that we're using.
Yes.
The first level that we're using is like a statistical analysis of shape recognition. And these are machine learning algorithms to group the objects in typologies of shapes and decorations. So this is a real emerging method in archaeology. Now, I'm sure all of your listeners have heard of shape recognition on their phones, or maybe when they go into Bunnings or Coles. Now, we'll do that same sort of thing with ceramics, sort of give them like a fingerprint. And then the second tier of analysis is that we take samples from these objects and determine their geochemical profiles. And this kind of work I've done throughout my career match objects that we find in certain places to their production site, or different objects to different objects.
Wow, this technology sounds like it's speeded up the work that archaeologists might once have done in a very manual way. Is that right?
Yeah, it certainly has. It's machine learning. is currently revolutionary in archaeology, I would say. Mm. It would be a great boon to us in this project.
Okay, so will that help then to perhaps retrospectively identify objects that have been removed from wrecks that I understand you might have access to in warehouses or museums and other places as well? I mean, what is there out there to identify that you're not necessarily plucking from the ocean floor?
We have this collection in Adelaide here of 2,300 objects, and we're hoping to sort of, you know, do that detective work to bring more cultural meaning. But, you know, every collection in Australia has trade ceramics that have been collected in this way. And I would say every collection in the world, art collection, public art collection in the world, has the trade ceramics as well that are languishing there just as aesthetic objects. And, you know, they certainly are beautiful, but there's also other stories to tell about them.
Well, the machine learning then sounds like a really interesting aspect, which is going to add a lot more to this identification. What else have you been finding there, Martin? I mean, not to say that ceramics aren't amazing treasures in themselves. I personally think they are. But what else have you found on the shipwrecks?
Well, I mean, there are a range of different goods that you can find on shipwrecks. I mean, there's a particular famous and controversial shipwreck called the Belitung shipwreck, which now resides at the Asian Civilizations Museum in Singapore, one part of it, and another part in this warehouse in West Java that we are working with. And there are a number of gold objects, sculptures, but they also found different kinds of grains and seeds inside the vessels themselves,
really?
Including star anise. Was a particular kind of a spice that they found. And this particular shipwreck is currently believed to be an Arab dhow, so perhaps from Oman. So perhaps it was travelling from China, from southern China, through Indonesia to return to Oman.
So we're talking about some epic sea journeys then here.
Yeah, it really is. I do understand, the perspective of some people about ceramics can be, what's interesting in a ceramic. And perhaps I was a little bit like that when I started my career as an archaeologist. But, you know, we can apply different scientific methods to ceramics themselves to actually understand what they held. Porcelain or stoneware, the glaze might crack and it might leave some residue inside it. So we can use different sort of methods like gas chromatography to discover what was actually inside the vessels.
So is that how you've discovered the spices, or have you actually found vessels that have remained sealed under the water with the actual spices in them?
No, that's what happened with this particular case.
How extraordinary.
Wow. Yes, yeah, it's quite amazing.
So Martin Polkinghorne is our guest this evening. He's an archaeologist, as you can hear, and he works on shipwrecks in Southeast Asia, recovering them in order to be able to understand more about the history and the culture of our region. So Martin, what is it that drives you to do this work? What do you love about it?
I've been working in Southeast Asia for over 20 years. I mean, my primary field of expertise is in the archaeology of Cambodia, and specifically Angkor. But really, I mean, what drives me personally is working with communities using archaeology as a way to investigate identity and heritage and protect heritage. And this is what's really driven this project as well, I would say, is sort of this idea of capacity building and protecting heritage for future and present generations. We're helping our Indonesian partners to manage their collection of 230,000 objects. I mean, a great privilege of mine as an archaeologist here in Australia is to welcome two Indonesian PhD students. And these are, you know, Indonesia's brightest maritime archaeologists. And it's really my great honour to supervise them and learn from them every day.
And what does it mean for those Indonesian archaeologists, or indeed for Indonesian people, when these objects go back to them? What does it mean to receive some of your history back?
Well, I think that it's sort of a great validating thing, really, sort of, you know, validates their the identity of Indonesia at the crossroads of the world. You know, in Indonesia, as I mentioned, the legislative framework and its implementation to protect these objects has been lacking or is in flux, but there's a huge chance for us from Australia, using expertise in Australia, but in, you know, deep collaboration with our Indonesian partners and these Indonesian PhD students, to work with local communities to tell the real stories behind this underwater cultural heritage. And it's an opportunity to protect these underwater sites in a way that lasts. You know, the Indonesian government and the ministry already has a range of programs in place in different places in Indonesia. And what they show is that when local communities really understand the local significance of ancient shipwrecks and their cargoes, they can really benefit in sustainable ways.
It's a good note to leave it on. Martin Polkinghorne, thank you so much for talking with us on Nightlife this evening.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure, Andrea. Thanks for having me.
There's Martin Polkinghorne there, the Associate Professor in Archaeology at Flinders University. He's a co-investigator on reuniting cargoes, the underwater cultural heritage of the Maritime Silk Route Research Project. And hopefully through his work and the work of many others, we might come to understand more about the Silk Route through the Southeast Asian shipping lanes, which was at least equal to the Silk Road that moved across the land from Asia to Europe.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.